This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. Black Americans protesting the violation of their rights are a defining tradition of this country. Most of these uprisings have brought consternation and hand-wringing, but few have brought cultural change. It feels different this time. That's what Nicole Hannah-Jones writes in her new article in the New York Times Magazine, where she's a correspondent focusing on racial justice. Her article is headlined, "If True Justice and Equality Are to Be Achieved in the U.S., It Must Finally Take Seriously What It Owes Black Americans." The article uses history to make the case for reparations. Nicole Hannah-Jones created the 1619 Project at the New York Times. It started off as a special issue of the New York Times Magazine devoted to the legacy of slavery, published 400 years after the first Africans arrived as enslaved people in the English colony of Virginia. Last month, Hannah-Jones won a Pulitzer Prize for the essay she contributed to the project. Less than 3 weeks later, George Floyd was killed, sparking protests around the world. Nicole Hannah-Jones is also the recipient of a MacArthur Fellowship, the so-called Genius Award, as well as a Peabody Award and a George Polk Award. She co-founded the Ida B. Wells Society for Investigative Reporting, which is dedicated to increasing the ranks of investigative reporters of color. Nicole Hannah-Jones, welcome back to Fresh Air, and congratulations on the Pulitzer and the 1619 Project. So I want to get to that first sentence in your new article, "It Feels Different This Time." What are some of the changes you see coming out of the protests that makes you think it's different this time?
Thank you for having me on the show again. The first thing is the sustained nature of these protests. It hasn't been just a few days. It's been weeks in some places of daily protests. It is how far spread the protests are. Protests have occurred in all 50 states. Protests have occurred in all white towns with pretty terrible racial track records. It's the multiracial nature of the protests. Oftentimes these protests are almost exclusively or very heavily black, but we are seeing protesters of all races. And it's also the multi-generational nature of the protests. You're seeing, you know, everyone from little kids to elderly people on canes. So that definitely is something that feels different, as well as how quickly some of the changes are occurring. People have been, for instance, protesting and trying to fight to get Confederate monuments and other monuments to people who openly engaged in white supremacy down for decades. And now all of these jurisdictions that said they didn't have the power nor the will to do it are doing it overnight. We in New York already have a police reform bill that passed in the state house, getting rid of chokeholds, trying to force the names of police officers who have been accused of violating certain protocols and practices to be made public. So in some ways, you've seen very swift changes that we have not seen before because of the sustained nature of the protests. But I should say that with a caveat, the larger, more important and structural changes, of course, have not occurred yet.
Yeah, I want to quote from your article. You write, "If we're truly at the precipice of a transformative moment, the most tragic of outcomes would be that the demand be too timid and the resolution too small." So you would like to see this moment lead to a national conversation about reparations. So what does the word reparations mean to you?
Reparations to me, and if you notice in the piece, which is quite long, we don't even use the word reparations until the very end section of the piece, because it's such a charged word. But what it means to me is it is restitution. It is when a country or a community or a corporation that has done something egregious to a person or a group of people tries to restore or repair the damage that was done. And that is what reparations is to me. In the context specifically of Black Americans, reparations has to do with 250 years of chattel slavery, followed by another 100 years of legalized segregation or apartheid and racial terrorism, and how that impacted the economic well-being of Black Americans, how that prevented generation after generation Black Americans from acquiring the type of wealth or foothold in the economy that allows you to live a life that is much more typical of white Americans, that allows you to truly take advantage of the bounty of this country. So reparations to me is about repair.
You say that this conversation about reparations actually dates back to the period just after the emancipation of enslaved people. What was the conversation like then?
Well, actually, the concept of reparations for slavery begins even before emancipation. Enslaved people who had gotten their freedom had begun trying to sue to get some kind of compensation for their enslavement even during slavery. But what happens at emancipation, we are often taught in this country that Black people are emancipated and then everyone is on an even footing. We don't often question, what does that mean to be emancipated after 250 years of bondage, to be emancipated with no job, no home, no money, no clothes, no bed, no pots, nothing. Enslaved people were unable to own anything. And so what happens at emancipation is this expectation that the government should help formerly enslaved people to get a foothold. And what Black people wanted more than anything was land. They didn't want dependency on the government. They wanted to be given some of the land that they had worked for generations so that they could become independent, so that they could make their own money and be independent of the white people who had ruled over them. And there were Black men who had served in the Union Army. There was a meeting that was held between some of these men and some generals from the Union Army. And they asked, well, what do you want? And what they said is, we want land. We want land so that we can be prosperous and be our own people. So General Sherman takes that to heart, and he issues Field Order Number 15. And Field Order Number 15 declares that Black families will get 40 acres of former Confederate land, and that they will be able to work that land. And actually, at the time, it was a loan. It wasn't even being given to enslaved people. It was on loan, and they would eventually make enough money and pay for the land. And for a brief period of time, this is what happened. A small number of formerly enslaved people in the Georgia Sea Islands and in coastal South Carolina had the land that they had once worked for white people turned over to them, and they began to farm it. But unfortunately, that period was very, very brief. President Lincoln was assassinated, and he was replaced by his vice president, Andrew Johnson, who was a Southerner, who was a white supremacist, and who believed, like many white Americans at that time, that Black people were deserving of nothing after slavery, that they should be grateful for their freedom. And he confiscated the land and returned the land to the former Confederates. And that ended the only real effort in the history of this country to provide reparations for those who had been enslaved. And it really left formerly enslaved people in absolute devastating poverty. There are stories of mass starvations of Black people after they had been freed, you know, having to leave the plantation and find shelter in burned out buildings, of trying to forage for food in burned out fields. It was a devastating period for Black people, and this country decided that it was going to do nothing, that it owed these people nothing.
Some people might be thinking, well, but slavery was so long ago. But as you point out, the history of slavery in the U.S., well, it actually starts before the U.S. was the U.S., but if you go back to the colonies, the history of slavery here is longer than the history of freedom for Black people.
Absolutely. So we practiced slavery in the British colonies that would become the United States starting in the year 1619. So for 250 years, we have not had slavery in this country for 150 years. But even that is a little misleading because, of course, the end of slavery is followed by a 100-year period of legal discrimination in this country. So Black people have only had full rights of citizenship. We have only lived in a country where it was not legal to discriminate against people simply because they descended from those who had been enslaved for a half a century. My father was born into a country where discrimination against Black people was legal. My father was born on a sharecropping farm, a cotton farm in Greenwood, Mississippi, where our family had once been enslaved. So we like to think that this was a long time ago. And 150 years is a long time. But when you think about the cumulative nature of disadvantage, it's not that long at all.
So I just want to take note of the fact that in your writing, you don't use the word slave, you use the word enslaved person or enslaved people. And it's a interesting distinction, and I want you to talk about that.
Yes, so it was very important in the 1619 Project, and whenever I write about this, to not use language that further dehumanizes people who every system and structure was designed to dehumanize. I think when we hear the word slave, we think of slavery as being the essence of that person. But if you call someone an enslaved person, then it speaks to a condition. Slavery was not, these people were not slaves. Someone chose to force them into the condition of slavery. And that language to me is very important, as is using the word enslaver over slave owner, because these people didn't have a moral right to own another human being, even though the society allowed it. And I think it needs to be active, that this was an active system of people choosing to treat other human beings as property.
Let's talk about the wealth gap. You write about how Black people haven't had the generational wealth to pass on to their children and to their grandchildren, and you trace that back to slavery and back to post-Reconstruction and back to segregation in the South. And you also describe the difference between income and generational wealth. So let's start there.
Sure. So income is what you get in your paycheck. You go to work, you work a certain hours a week, and then you get a paycheck. And that's what most of us use to pay our bills every month. But wealth is your assets minus your debts. And so wealth tends to be something that we don't create just on our own. A lot of us in this country inherit wealth, and we get money from our family members if we want to go to college or we want to purchase a home. So wealth is what's actually accumulated over time. Very few Americans have created all of their wealth on their own. It's passed down through generations and then built upon. Black Americans never really had a chance to do that. Of course, 250 years of slavery where they're unable to accumulate any capital. And then coming out of slavery, Black Americans faced a dragnet of discrimination and segregation that further prevented them from building any type of wealth. Black people were denied access to colleges, were denied access to high schools, were denied access to higher paying jobs. And when Black people were able to get some land or to build a business, oftentimes they faced those businesses being stolen or burned down or destroyed. So we saw really from 1619 until 1968, when the last of the civil rights legislation was passed, saying you could no longer discriminate against Black Americans, Black people being denied access to the primary wealth building tools, home ownership, federally financed loans, you know, the GI Bill to be able to purchase housing that white Americans use to build their wealth. And so what we see today is this stark chasm that was built up over generations, and then only made worse by the fact that today Black Americans still face discrimination across the spectrum of American life.
Do you see reparations as cash, as opportunity, as jobs, as housing? What do you think is the best way of doing something with lasting impact and with impact that could last over generations?
I think that reparations can't just be any one thing. I think that you have to have targeted investment in Black communities and Black schools that have been generationally under-resourced. You certainly need to have a commitment to strong enforcement of existing civil rights laws, because reparations don't do any good if you're still facing rampant employment and housing and educational discrimination. But the center of any reparations program has to be cash payments. The only thing that closes a wealth gap is money. And I think a lot of the times when we have these discussions about, well, let's give scholarships and let's pay for Black people to go to college. One, the facts show that Black people with a college degree still earn less than white people, still have less wealth than white Americans who have a high school degree. So again, that discomfort with a cash payment is something I think we need to understand is also racialized. And this belief that Black people are not deserving or won't spend their money the way that people think that they should. But you cannot close a racial wealth gap without transferring wealth to the people who have the gap. So cash payments, to me, have to be centered to any program.
So how much? I mean, cash payments could be like $100, $1,000, $10,000, $100,000. Like, has that been part of the conversation yet? Like, how much money are we talking about?
There's certainly different scholars and activists who have worked on figures. Frankly, I'm less worried about the technical arguments. We can figure out how to send someone to the moon. We certainly can figure out a calculus for how much the descendants should get, how much is practical. What's much more challenging is convincing Americans that this is the right thing to do. If we look at what the wealth gap is, some people would say payments of $100,000 to $170,000 to close the racial wealth gap. Some people would argue for more, some people would argue for less. But this is why there's been a bill to study the issue of reparations in Congress now for more than 30 years. To answer those questions, and yet Congress will not even pass the bill out of committee.
Yeah, the bill was introduced by the late John Conyers. What's in the bill?
I mean, the bill is to produce a study committee to actually just study the issue of reparations. Should the descendants of enslaved people in this country be paid reparations? How would a program work? So all of those questions that people love to throw up to say, well, we can't do reparations because how would we do it? Well, there's been a bill that would study how to do it, and it has not been able to get enough support to get out of committee in Congress. So those are all questions that can be answered. The hardest part is to get the will in a society that has tried to downplay slavery, that has tried to downplay the role that racism has played, and has tried to downplay the singularity of the Black experience, that no other group in this country has had the same experience. And so I think that has been the biggest issue that we faced.
What reaction do you get when you talk about reparations with white people?
It depends. I haven't had a ton of conversations. This hasn't been my life's work. It's been something I've thought about for a long time, but it's not something that I've talked about regularly in public spaces. I think the initial response is almost always a defensiveness, almost always a sense that the concept of reparations is unfair. Well, what about, you know, poor white people? Why should Black people get something for something that happened a long time ago? And I try to steer right into that discomfort. What is it about talking about reparations for Black people specifically? Because we understand the concept of reparations in the law. If a hospital kills my husband because of malpractice, we understand that even though I'm not the victim, that financial compensation in our law is a right way to address what has happened. We have paid reparations to the Japanese, for instance. We understand when Germany paid reparations to Holocaust survivors. So we get that concept in the law, but we have a very visceral reaction to Black people getting reparations. And that speaks to this ongoing narrative in America that tries to downplay slavery, and that we've really internalized a sense that Black people are undeserving and have gotten enough. So I try to steer, when I have those conversations with white Americans, right into that discomfort and then make the case, because I think if you just look at the facts of it, if you're open to the facts of it, I think it is hard to come away saying that this is not the moral and just thing to do.
You write that reparations aren't about punishing white people. I think that's an important point because I think a lot of people feel like it is about that.
Yeah, I mean, I wanted to address that head on because I wanted to really get at why do we have this kind of visceral response, negative response to the idea of making restitution to people who we held in chattel slavery and who we allowed really the most egregious discrimination, legal discrimination that's antithetical to our idea of who we believe we are as Americans. And why do we respond that way? And I think it's because a lot of white Americans feel that reparations isn't a personal attack, that they are being accused of something or they are expected to feel guilty about things that they did not personally do. It's important to understand that reparations are to be paid by the federal government, that the federal government sanctioned the institution of slavery, and that this is a societal debt. It is not the debt of one race. It is certainly not the debt of people who did not themselves engage in slavery or Jim Crow, but it is a debt that our society owns. And as I say in the piece, you don't get to just claim the good parts of the society, a part of the society that makes you proud, that glorifies your country. You have to also own up to a society's wrongs. People should not feel that reparations is something personal. It is not.
Nicole Hannah-Jones, it's been great to have you back on our show. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this. And I wish you and your family good health.
Thank you. You as well.
Nicole Hannah-Jones created the New York Times 1619 Project and is a correspondent for the New York Times Magazine, focusing on racial injustice. Her new article in the magazine is headlined, "If True Justice and Equality Are to Be Achieved in the U.S., It Must Finally Take Seriously What It Owes Black Americans." Two years ago, Lady Gaga got raves for playing a sensitive singer-songwriter in the film A Star Is Born. But now she's gone back to the dance floor for a new collection of disco-based songs called Chromatica. The album's a big hit, debuting at number one. Less popular, but deserving just as much acclaim, is Carly Rae Jepsen's new album of imaginative dance music called Dedicated Side B. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of both albums.
Show me a real good time. I never asked for the rainbow. At least I showed up. You showed me nothing at all. It's coming down on me. Harder like misery. It's coming down on me. I'm ready, rain on me. Drop, but at least I'm alive.
During the current moment, many musicians are offering their music as comfort via the internet, playing mostly acoustic, sometimes in collaboration with other players, zooming in quietly from different locations. As a human being, I appreciate this effort. As a critic, though, I find it lacking what I really want right now. Rather than acoustic versions of greatest hits, I find myself craving new material that has some noisy passion to it. I yearn for the sound of electric instrumentation providing the jolt of good rock music, hip-hop, and dance music. Now come two collections that satisfy some of that need. The first is Lady Gaga's Chromatica, an album filled with flashy disco. You're the one.
Look at me.
After the success Lady Gaga enjoyed singing mawkish singer-songwriter pop in A Star Is Born, I am so glad she returned to the dance floor with a vehemently silly song like the one I just played called Stupid Love. Its frenetic passion is a reminder that Gaga is also the author of 2013's Art Pop, a gloriously over-the-top collection of would-be avant-garde tunes. The lyrics on this new album, Chromatica, speak frequently of soul-deep melancholy and struggles for self-esteem, but the words are wrapped in music that contradicts the pain.
Feeling something that I can't explain. Think it's a wound I still entertain. I'd do anything to numb the flame. I guess I'm just on fire these days.
The other album of big, bold, brassy music that's making isolation less lonely is Carly Rae Jepsen's Dedicated Side B, a collection of songs Jepsen says she left off last year's album Dedicated. But Dedicated Side B doesn't sound like Leftovers to me.
Baby, I could praise you. Try to turn your head around. Could you take a compliment?
That's Window, as good a pop song as I've heard since I started hoarding toilet paper. Jepsen fascinates me. She's made a string of excellent albums, all featuring wispy, echoed vocals that should not be as expressive as they are, singing curt, crisp, disco-based tunes that shouldn't be as memorable as they are. She's adept at pop that has no patience for phony melodrama, as you can hear on this song called Fake Mona Lisa.
It's born in Vegas, among the stars, and on his cheek, beauty mark, barely noticed, and from the start, constellation, stunned my heart.
I understand why Carly Rae Jepsen isn't as massively popular as Lady Gaga. Her persona isn't as extravagantly dramatic. Her compositions are more tidy and precise. But that doesn't mean her music isn't as strong. Jepsen recently said she's recorded what she calls a quarantine album in collaboration with producer Tavish Crowe, with whom she wrote her 2011 breakthrough hit Call Me Maybe. It doesn't have a release date yet, but it's the first bit of quarantine music I'm actually looking forward to.
Ken Tucker reviewed Carly Rae Jepsen's new album, Dedicated Side B, and Lady Gaga's new album, Chromatica. Coming up, we'll talk about the use of LSD, psilocybin, MDMA, and marijuana to treat mental health issues with psychiatrist Julie Holland. Her new book is called Good Chemistry. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. We've talked before on Fresh Air about how psychedelic drugs, including LSD, psilocybin, MDMA, and marijuana, are being used experimentally in clinic settings to treat mental health issues. My guest, Dr. Julie Holland, is one of the psychiatrists involved with that research. She's a medical monitor on studies testing the use of cannabis and MDMA on post-traumatic stress disorder. These are studies being sponsored by the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, known by the acronym MAPS, which is also involved with developing psychedelics into prescription medication. Holland is a psychiatrist specializing in psychopharmacology. She has a private practice in Manhattan. From 1996 to 2005, she was in charge of Bellevue Hospital's psychiatric emergency room on weekends. Her new book is called Good Chemistry, The Science of Connection from Soul to Psychedelics. Dr. Julie Holland, welcome back to Fresh Air. Why are you interested in using psychedelics for therapy?
Well, quite a few things here. There are certain plant medicines in particular, things like psilocybin or ayahuasca, that really help people not only explore their personal trauma and maybe do a little bit of debriefing and coming to terms with their traumas, but also there's often this feeling of unity and connection, connectedness and oneness that can be very powerful and potentially transformative. People really come away from these experiences having a new perspective that everything is connected and interconnected and that they are part of that interconnectedness. And that can be not only good for your psychology, but also your physiology, your body. So that's the main issue. But for MDMA-assisted psychotherapy in particular, it's just a perfectly designed drug to be a catalyst to allow psychotherapy to go deeper and be more efficient and more effective, basically. So, you know, good psychotherapy takes years, and there's a lot of fits and starts, and people run away when things get too heavy. So to have something akin to anesthesia during surgery that allows people to be more open and vulnerable and also feeling strong enough and calm enough that they can really explore their traumas, that's incredibly helpful for the field of psychiatry, and we've never had anything like this before.
Your specialty is psychopharmacology, which means using medications to treat mental health issues. Have you been disappointed in the current crop of drugs to treat things like PTSD and depression, anxiety?
Absolutely, no question. And, you know, I have to say that the crop is pretty old. First of all, the antidepressants, you know, we haven't had a lot of innovation in antidepressants in a long time. And, you know, people got on these medicines and then they never got off. And a lot of people are taking antidepressants for decades, and they really weren't designed to be used that way. So that's sort of a number one issue. But things are absolutely changing, where people are having a better understanding that it's not as simple as just, you know, altered chemistry or altered genetics, that your childhood experiences and trauma and things like income inequality, there's all sorts of things that have an impact on what your mental health is going to be. And a big part of it is processing trauma. So a lot of these, the daily doses of antidepressants, anti-anxiety medicines, sleeping pills, antipsychotics, they're not there to help the primary problem. They're there to sort of, you know, seal up the cracks and act as Band-Aids. And whereas psychedelic-assisted psychotherapy is really trying to get to the root cause of the symptoms instead of just sort of papering over the symptoms.
I know you have concerns about the widespread use of antidepressants, about their side effects, about the difficulty of going off them, about how a lot of doctors who prescribe them aren't actually psychiatrists. But do you see benefits with antidepressants in a lot of your patients?
Yes, absolutely. And I should make that more clear. I mean, this is something that my main job is that I prescribe antidepressants and anti-anxiety medicines and sleeping pills and sometimes mood stabilizers, antipsychotics. There are medicines that work very well. My patients are doing very well and they're taking these medicines. So I don't want to completely disparage it. It's just for some people, it's not really what they need. It's not appropriate. But for other people, they need to stay on their meds, and it's very dangerous to go off their medicines. So I don't mean to imply that everybody should throw their pills away at all. But I do think for people who have been on just antidepressants for decades, that it is worth exploring whether there aren't other ways that maybe you could treat some of the symptoms and maybe get at some of the underlying causes of the symptoms. I don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater, but there are some people who absolutely need medicines, and yes, these medicines do give them a benefit, but they really weren't designed to be taken for decades on end.
Both of the studies that you're monitoring now are working with patients who have post-traumatic stress disorder. Why was PTSD chosen as the subject for these experiments with cannabis and with MDMA?
Well, there are a few reasons. I mean, the anecdotal data was very strong for both of these medicines, that they help people with PTSD, and also that the current treatments that are available are grossly inadequate for treating PTSD. They're all about just covering up symptoms and not really getting to the root cause of any of the symptoms. So this is sort of a new paradigm, a revolutionary way to treat trauma, where you're not just the symptoms, when people are traumatized, they get very anxious, they get sort of hyper-aroused, they can't sleep well, they can't eat well, and, you know, you can give medicines to decrease anxiety or medications to help with sleep, but you're not really getting to the root cause, which is that they've been traumatized and they need to further process the trauma and work through the trauma. Sometimes it gets sort of trapped in your body and you're very sort of physically agitated, but if you can have very deep psychotherapy to address the trauma and to arrive at some sort of a place of equanimity or peace and acceptance that this trauma did happen and that you have to fully integrate it. You know, people tend to sort of splinter off the parts of themselves that got hurt and they end up less and less integrated. So part of oneness and connection is just being one with yourself and connected with yourself.
Let's talk about the use of MDMA, aka Molly or ecstasy, in a clinical use in treating mental health issues. You are a medical monitor in a study examining this. And like with the cannabis study, this is with people who have post-traumatic stress disorder. Why choose MDMA as a drug for post-traumatic stress disorder?
Well, MDMA is just a exquisitely perfect chemical for augmenting the process of psychotherapy. MDMA helps people to feel more relaxed and more open and trusting, and more trusting of the therapist, which is important. But because it's got sort of a methamphetamine base, it helps people be awake, alert, verbal, want to talk, want to explore. But also because it increases serotonin, there is a feeling of very little anxiety, and also a feeling of satiety, like you don't really need anything, like you have everything you need. So this high dopamine, high serotonin, and also high oxytocin state makes it really great for being open, being trusting, being able to explore traumas comfortably, and trusting your therapist that they're going to help you to explore these traumas safely. And this feeling of safety is actually very important. MDMA, because it increases oxytocin, there is a quieting of the amygdala, the fear response. Because exploring trauma is scary, and often if people become afraid, they close down and they don't want to talk and they don't want to explore.
So you mentioned oxytocin. What is oxytocin?
So oxytocin is a hormone and a neurotransmitter that enables the kind of openness and trusting and bonding that underlies human connection, cooperation, communication. So high oxytocin states are states that have this very intense bonding, either, for instance, like a nursing mother and her infant. There's a lot of oxytocin happening there in both the baby and the mother that help to solidify the bond. And orgasm is another high oxytocin state, which helps to solidify a bond between partners. And the other time that you see high oxytocin states, though, is in social cohesion, feeling part of a group, feeling like you belong. This, anytime there's a sense of unity or oneness or connection, almost always you will see oxytocin involved.
Is there an example of someone you could talk about who emerged from MDMA-assisted therapy feeling more integrated, feeling less traumatized, feeling more comfortable in the world?
Pretty much everybody that I've spoken to who has had an MDMA-assisted psychotherapy session has come away from it feeling like they have processed a good deal of their trauma, maybe not all of their trauma, but they certainly have a better sort of lay of the land of what it looks like. You know, I don't want to sort of divulge my patients' stories. I mean, I have a patient who had a her spouse committed suicide, and she had a very hard time sort of forgiving him or processing that. And, you know, she was able to do that in one session, and to just, you know, leave some of that weight and heaviness there in the therapy room. I've had patients who have stopped self-harming or, you know, picking at themselves. I have had patients who are no longer feeling compulsively suicidal. Lots of patients who have changed their behaviors around alcohol or eating compulsively or drug abuse. Sasha Shulgin actually described it as penicillin for the soul, and that it is sort of a broad spectrum antibiotic. It does have a lot of different uses. It's not specific to one illness or one set of complaints, because it really gets at fundamental causes for a lot of discomfort, psychic discomfort.
In your private practice, you're not allowed to prescribe MDMA. So how are you able to have patients who are using it, or are you just referring to the study that you're monitoring?
I've had a private practice in New York City for like 25 years, and there are plenty of opportunities for underground therapists who are working with MDMA or psilocybin, or there are ayahuasca circles, or, you know, it's not hard to find practitioners in a densely populated area who are doing this kind of work. So I have had patients come to me who have already done this work or who are interested in this work, and they know where to go. And it's not, I'm not doing this work and I'm not sending them to do this work, but they're out there. The underground therapists are all over the United States and all over the world, and they are already doing this work. There are people who appreciate how potentially potent and efficient and effective these medicines are, and they're already doing this kind of work. And so I think, you know, my job, because I'm very interested in harm reduction and trying to make sure that if people are going to do risky things, they do it more safely. And one of the things that comes up a lot is that people are on medication. They're on antidepressants. They've been on antidepressants for years, but you really can't be on these antidepressants if you want to do this kind of work. So things like psilocybin, ayahuasca, MDMA, none of them really play well with others, and especially not with antidepressants. So sometimes I'm in the process of trying to very slowly and gently and carefully change a person's medicines around so that they will be able to experience these other medicines. And that's sort of tricky work.
Why don't they go together?
Well, for instance, in the case of antidepressants and MDMA, the SSRIs, the most commonly prescribed antidepressants, and by the way, 80% of these antidepressants are prescribed by people who aren't psychiatrists, and they just get renewed over and over. So antidepressants that work on serotonin, what are called the SSRIs, where they sit is exactly where MDMA needs to go to do the work. So they absolutely block the reuptake site. So if you're taking an SSRI, you basically won't feel MDMA if you take it. And then you have something like ayahuasca, which is very popular, which is a psychedelic tea. And there are a bunch of medicines that you cannot take if you're going to have an ayahuasca experience. And so, you know, there needs to be some sort of medical monitoring sometimes in these situations, because you know, I don't want people to do things that are potentially deadly when they could have a positive growth experience if they just weren't taking certain medicines. And speaking of growth, there's one thing I just want to mention, because it's so important, is that a lot of these medicines we're talking about, like ayahuasca and psilocybin, MDMA, cannabis, they all facilitate what's called neuroplasticity, which is the brain sort of growing and changing and rewiring. And there are things called synaptogenesis, which is like new synapses forming, and then there's neurogenesis, which is new brain cells forming. And so, you know, we all have this idea that like drugs kill brain cells, that like these drugs kill brain cells, but it's actually the exact opposite, that a lot of these plant medicines and psychedelic medicines, they engender brain cell growth and what's called neuroplasticity, which is sort of new connections being formed, and potentially the brain being somewhat rewired. Which really helps, that's what's fostering the growth and the change in behavior. And you don't necessarily see a lot of growth and change in behavior when people are taking antidepressants or even maybe going to therapy for years. I mean, with really good therapy and you go for years, you do have behavioral changes. But to see them after one session is really remarkable. And it's hard to just go back to, you know, the daily dose after you see this kind of tremendous behavioral change.
Let's talk a little bit about anxiety, because this is certainly a time of great anxiety. What kind of symptoms are you seeing in your patients related to anxiety now?
Well, here's what I would say is that even before the pandemic and the sort of political unrest, I had patients who were extremely anxious just by the current political situation, or, you know, some people are upset about the environment and what's happening. So our anxiety levels were already pretty high. And, you know, basically since the 90s, the numbers have just been going up and up on prescription anti-anxiety medicines being used. And we saw a big spike around 9/11, and we're going to see a big spike now as well. So it's pervasive. It's an ongoing problem. Anxiety has sort of overtaken depression as the number one complaint, really, not only with psychiatrists, but just sort of general medical practitioners. You know, you have to keep in mind about 80% of the psychiatric medicines in our country are written by GPs and people who aren't psychiatrists. So if somebody comes in and they're stressed and they're anxious and they're not sleeping well, and you give them a prescription, you send them on their way, but then they end up taking those pills on a regular basis, and they're hard to get off. So yes, now we're definitely seeing more anxiety. And one thing that I think is really important to talk about is that at the beginning of the pandemic, there was anxiety about contracting the virus. But what's happened over the last several months is there is, besides the sort of pervading sense of anxiety and doom, is that the people who've been isolated, the people who are living alone, my patients haven't had any human touch for 3 months. And being that isolated and that disconnected will make you more anxious. It will make it harder to sleep. It puts you in sympathetic mode. It puts you in fight or flight. So being isolated takes you out of the parasympathetic. It makes it harder to be social, which is sort of paradoxical, right? You're already not social, and then you've got this sort of side effect of having worse social skills because you're isolated. So it feeds on itself. So that's the thing I'm really worried about now, is that the isolation and the disconnection affects the physiology, makes people more anxious, and then they don't sleep well, they don't eat well, they're trying to soothe themselves with all these unhealthy behaviors, and it's just, it all cycles on itself.
Julie Holland, thank you so much for talking with us.
It was absolutely my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Julie Holland is a psychiatrist and author of the new book, Good Chemistry. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering from Mike Villers. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Salek, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Thea Challoner, Seth Kelly, and Joel Wolfram. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.